Welcome to another deep dive. Looks like you've sent us some pretty interesting material on the Synoptic Gospels, and it looks like you're really getting into some serious biblical scholarship with this whole synoptic problem thing.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area for sure.
Yeah.
We've got these three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that tell the story of Jesus. And on the surface, they seem so similar, but then you start to notice all these subtle differences,
Yeah.
almost like they're each looking at the same event from slightly different angles.
It's true. It's kind of like those spot the difference puzzles. So instead of pictures, we're dealing with accounts of some pretty significant historical events. And the big question is, why are they different? What do these variations tell us about how these gospels came to be?
And one of the first things that jumps out at you when you start comparing them side by side are the verbal variations. It's not just the overall flow of the story that's similar, but even the specific words and phrases used in certain passages.
Yeah, I noticed that when I was reading the parable of the sower. All three gospels tell the same story, but sometimes there's a word added here, a word omitted there. Like sometimes there's behold, and sometimes it's just missing. Or they'll use different verb tenses to describe the same action. It's like they're playing this subtle game of mix and match with the language.
And what makes it even more curious is that these variations don't seem random or accidental. They seem intentional, like the authors are deliberately choosing to emphasize certain aspects or nuances. For example, Henry Alford, a biblical scholar from the 19th century, he studied these variations extensively and found these fascinating patterns, patterns that suggest a deliberate literary hand at work.
So it's not just a case of sloppy note-taking or faulty memory. These differences seem to be part of a bigger puzzle.
Precisely. And then you have scholars like Philip Schaff, who took this statistical approach. He actually analyzed the Gospels to determine the percentage of unique words in each one. His findings. Mark has the lowest percentage of unique words, coming in at around 40%. Matthew and Luke have significantly more, 56% and 67%, respectively.
Okay, so Mark is the most similar to the other two in terms of language. Is that what leads many scholars to believe that Mark was the first gospel written?
It's one piece of the puzzle,
Mm-hmm.
but it's not just the language. The order of events also plays a role. For the most part, the Synoptic Gospels follow a similar sequence, but there are some intriguing discrepancies. The healing of Peter's mother-in-law and the cleansing of the temple, for example, don't appear in the same order in all three Gospels.
So which one is right? Did one of the gospel writers get the timeline mixed up?
That's the thing. We can't necessarily assume that there's one correct order. Ancient narratives weren't always strictly chronological. Sometimes events were arranged topically or thematically to emphasize certain points. Plus, we're dealing with oral tradition, where stories are passed down or retold, which can naturally lead to variations in sequencing.
So it's possible that what seem like discrepancies might actually be different ways of presenting the same events for different purposes. Interesting. Okay, so we've got these verbal variations and some intriguing differences in the order of events. But what about the content itself? How much overlap is there in what each gospel chooses to include?
That's where the Venn diagram comes in handy. Imagine three overlapping circles, one for Matthew, one for Mark, and one for Luke. Where they intersect is the material they all share, and then you have segments that are unique to each gospel.
Right. And I remember from Tyson's study that Luke has the most unique material with something like 500 verses not found in the other gospels. Matthew comes next with around 280 unique verses, and Mark has the fewest, only about 50.
Yes, and scholars like Alan Barr have developed visual representations of this overlap, these intricate diagrams and color-coded charts that highlight the shared and unique content. It's really quite remarkable how much effort has gone into analyzing and comparing these texts.
Speaking of analyzing and comparing, there were some early attempts to create systems for categorizing these overlaps, right? What about those Eusebian canons? Can you explain what those are and why they're significant?
Absolutely. Eusebius, a church historian from the 4th century, created this system for indexing parallel accounts in the Gospels. Actually, all four Gospels, including John. Imagine taking each Gospel and dividing it into numbered sections, then creating a table that shows which sections correspond to each other across the Gospels. That's essentially what the Eusebian canons are.
Okay, so it's like a giant spreadsheet for comparing the Gospels verse by verse. Pretty impressive for the 4th century, but why is it significant?
One of the interesting things the canons highlight is that there's no section where only Mark, Luke, and John overlap. It's always a combination of two gospels or all four.
Fascinating. So John really does stand apart in a way.
Yeah.
But then there's that big chunk of content, those sayings and teachings of Jesus that Matthew and Luke share, that's not found in Mark at all.
Right. And that's where the concept of the Q source comes in. It's this hypothetical collection of Jesus's sayings that scholars believe both Matthew and Luke drew from. No physical copy of this Q source has ever been found, but its existence is inferred from the material shared by Matthew and Luke that isn't in Mark.
So it's like this lost scroll of wisdom from the early church. I'm sensing the synoptic problem is more like a multi-layered enigma.
It certainly is. And over the centuries, scholars have come up with this whole range of theories to try to solve it. We could spend hours just outlining the different theories and their proponents.
Well, let's dive into that then. Give me the highlights. What are some of the major schools of thought when it comes to explaining these similarities and differences?
Well, one of the earliest attempts to harmonize the Gospels came from Toei, a Syrian Christian who lived in the second century. He created something called the Diatessaron, which essentially weaves together the four Gospels into a single continuous narrative.
So kind of like a director's cut of the Jesus story.
You could say that. It shows how early Christians were already grappling with the question of how to reconcile these different accounts.
Makes sense. Were there any other notable attempts to address the synoptic problem in the early church?
Definitely. A few centuries after Tatian, we have Eusebius, who, as we mentioned earlier, developed those intricate canons for indexing parallel passages in the Gospels.
Right.
This was a significant step toward a more systematic comparison of the texts. And then there's Augustine of Hippo, one of the most influential theologians in Christian history. In his work, Harmony of the Evangelists, he tackled the challenge of determining when seemingly similar events in the Gospels should be considered the same event or separate occurrences.
That sounds tricky. It's like trying to figure out if two witnesses are describing the same car accident from different angles, or if they actually saw two different accidents.
Exactly. It raises questions about how we interpret these accounts and whether we should always expect a strict one-to-one correspondence in the details.
So Augustine was wrestling with some of the same questions we're still asking today. What happened after Augustine? Did the synoptic problem fade into the background for a while?
It did for a time. After the fall of the Roman Empire, literacy rates declined, and biblical scholarship took a bit of a back seat. But then, during the Renaissance and Reformation periods, there was this renewed interest in the Bible and its origins.
Right.
Which sparked a fresh wave of attempts to solve the synoptic problem.
It's amazing how historical events can influence the pursuit of knowledge.
Right.
What new ideas emerged during this revival of biblical studies?
Well, one of the theories that gained traction was the idea of a primitive gospel, sometimes called the Ur-Evangelium.
Okay.
The idea here is that there was this original gospel, perhaps written in Aramaic, that served as the source material for Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The similarities between the gospels would then be explained by their shared dependence on this lost Ur-gospel, while the differences would arise from variations in translation or editing.
So a kind of missing link in the gospel lineage. It's like those paleontologists piecing together dinosaur skeletons from fragments. But what about the order in which the gospels were written? Did any consensus emerge on that?
Not really. The successive dependence theory, which Augustine had first proposed, came back into vogue, but with a twist. Instead of just one proposed order, every possible order was suggested: Matthew, Mark, Luke, Mark, Matthew, Luke, Mark, Luke, Matthew.
So at that point, it was kind of a free-for-all.
It became a bit of a scholarly free-for-all.
It sounds like everyone had their favorite gospel order.
Indeed. And then there was Friedrich Schleiermacher, who came up with the fragmentary theory.
Okay.
He envisioned these written fragments, anecdotes, sayings, snippets of narrative circulating in the early church. And he proposed that Matthew, Mark, and Luke each independently collected and assembled these fragments into their gospels.
Like a kind of biblical jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
Did that theory hold up?
Not entirely. It had some limitations, and it didn't fully account for the extent of the similarities between the Gospels. But it did highlight the potential role of written sources in the composition process. A similar idea, though focusing on oral sources rather than written fragments, was put forward by Brooke Foss Westcott and Fenton John Anthony Hort with their oral tradition theory.
Okay.
They argued that the similarities between the Gospels stemmed from this common body of oral tradition passed down from the apostles.
Right.
And each Gospel writer drew upon this shared pool of knowledge.
So it's like a campfire story that gets told and retold, taking on slightly different variations with each telling.
Exactly. And it makes sense considering the context of the early church, where oral communication played a vital role in spreading the message of Jesus.
Okay, so we've got these various theories, some emphasizing written sources, others emphasizing oral tradition.
Right.
Was there one that ultimately gained the most traction?
Yes. The one that really took hold and has remained dominant in biblical scholarship is the two-document theory.
Ah, yes. This is where that mysterious Q source makes a comeback, right? Before we get into that, can you remind me again what the Q source is exactly?
Of course. The Q source, short for Quelle, which is German for source, is this hypothetical document that scholars believe contained a collection of Jesus' sayings and teachings. No physical copy of Q has ever been found, but its existence is inferred from the material shared by Matthew and Luke that isn't found in Mark.
Okay, got it. So how does this Q source fit into the two-document theory?
The two-document theory, championed by scholars like Johann Gottfried Eichhorn, Bernhard Weiss, and Heinrich Julius Holtzmann in the 19th century, proposes that both Matthew and Luke used two primary sources in writing their Gospels. Mark, in this hypothetical Q document, Mark's Gospel would explain the shared narrative structure, while Q would account for the sayings and teachings unique to Matthew and Luke.
Okay, so Mark and Q are like the two pillars of this theory.
Right.
It seems pretty straightforward so far.
It does. However, there are some complexities. For example, if Matthew and Luke both had access to Mark, why are there still differences in how they present certain events or teachings? And what about those bits of unique content that we see in each Gospel, those stories or sayings that aren't found in either Mark or the hypothetical Q source?
Those are great questions. Does the two-document theory address those issues?
It tries to. Some scholars suggest that Matthew and Luke might have had slightly different versions of Mark, or they might have edited or rearranged material from Mark to fit their own theological purposes. And as for those unique bits of content, well, that's where B.H. Streeter comes in.
Oh, I remember reading about Streeter. Didn't he propose an expanded version of the two-document theory?
Exactly. He called it the four-document theory.
Four documents. Okay, I'm all ears. Walk me through this.
Streeter argued that in addition to Mark and Q, Matthew had his own unique source, which he labeled M, and Luke had his own unique source, which he labeled L. These sources would account for the material that's unique to each gospel. So now instead of just two sources, we have four hypothetical documents swirling around.
Wow. This is getting pretty complex. Are we done yet with theories or is there more?
Well, just to add another layer to this intricate tapestry, there's form criticism, which emerged in the early 20th century.
From what I've read, form criticism seems to kind of blend the oral tradition theory with the two-document theory. Am I right about that?
You are. Think of it this way. Mark and Q, these written sources, are sitting atop a cloud of oral tradition.
Okay.
Matthew and Luke would have had access to both these written sources and this broader oral tradition, resulting in this dynamic interplay between written and oral elements. It's not an either-or situation.
I can see how form criticism adds a layer of nuance to this whole puzzle. Okay, we've explored a lot of different theories here. I'm curious, what's your take on all this? Is there a particular model that resonates with you the most?
That's a great question, and one I've grappled with for quite some time. If we connect this to the bigger picture, considering both the internal evidence within the Gospels themselves and the external evidence from early church tradition, I lean towards a model that acknowledges the influence of both oral and written sources. It's a bit more nuanced than the traditional two-document theory.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Tell me more. What does this nuanced model look like?
Well, this model suggests that while all three synoptic gospels drew heavily from a common source, the oral testimony of the apostles Matthew and Luke were actually written before Mark.
Wait, so you're saying Matthew and Luke came before Mark? But doesn't that contradict the two-document theory, which places Mark as the earliest gospel?
It does challenge the conventional view, and this theory is not as widely accepted. But hear me out. After Jesus' ascension, the apostles spent a considerable amount of time together, sharing their experiences and solidifying their understanding of Jesus' teachings.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, being a prominent figure among them, would have naturally played a key role in shaping this collective memory and testimony.
So Peter's preaching and teaching would become a sort of proto-gospel, influencing both Matthew and Luke's writing.
Exactly. Now, Matthew, drawing upon his own memory and this shared apostolic testimony, wrote his gospel, possibly first in Hebrew and then translated into Greek. Luke, during his time with Paul in Caesarea, conducted extensive interviews, gathering information from apostles, disciples, and eyewitnesses, including those who had heard Peter's preaching.
Ah, so Luke was doing some serious investigative journalism, piecing together the story from multiple sources.
Absolutely.
I like how he took such a thorough approach.
And then we have Mark, who, according to tradition, has spent considerable time with Peter in Rome. It's believed that Mark's gospel is essentially a written record of Peter's preaching, capturing the essence of his perspective.
Okay, I'm starting to see how this model accounts for the similarities between the Gospels.
Right.
They all draw from the shared wellspring of apostolic testimony, especially Peter's influential voice.
Right.
But what about those differences, the ones we talked about earlier? How does this model explain those intriguing variations?
Well, for starters, Jesus himself was an itinerant preacher, often repeating his teachings and adapting them to different audiences and contexts.
So different strokes for different folks.
Right. This means that Matthew and Luke might be recording different instances of Jesus saying essentially the same thing, but with subtle variations in wording or emphasis.
That's a good point. And didn't you also mention that Jewish rabbis often taught their students by rote memorization? Couldn't that have been happening in the early church as well?
It's certainly a possibility. Imagine the disciples, eager to preserve Jesus' words, committing them to memory. But even the best memories have their quirks.
Yeah, no, I can't always remember things exactly as they happened. I might get the gist of a story, but I might mix up some details.
Exactly. And when you add in the natural fluidity of oral storytelling, it's not surprising that we see some variations in the Gospels.
It's like that game of telephone, where a message gets passed from person to person, and by the end, it's completely different from how it started.
A very apt analogy. But there's more.
I'm intrigued. What other factors could have contributed to these variations?
Well, different people experience and remember events in unique ways. Imagine a group of friends witnessing a car accident. They'll all have slightly different perspectives on what happened, even if they agree on the basic facts.
It's like the classic Rashomon effect.
Precise.
Everyone sees things from their own point of view.
And it's important to remember that the gospel writers weren't striving for a word-for-word verbatim account.
Okay.
They were skilled storytellers, shaping their narratives to emphasize particular themes or teachings.
So it's less about a strict journalistic approach and more about a theological and literary artistry.
Exactly. They selected, arranged, and summarized, all while remaining faithful to the core truths they were conveying. And let's not forget the practical limitations of writing in the ancient world. Papyrus was expensive, scrolls were bulky, and the gospel writers were likely trying to keep their works concise and accessible.
They had to be mindful of their word count.
Exactly. So they made choices like what to include, what to omit, and how to summarize, all while staying true to the essence of the story.
This model is really starting to make a lot of sense to me, especially considering the historical context and the nature of oral and written communication back then.
Right.
But I have to ask, how do we reconcile all of this with the idea of biblical inspiration? If these gospels are the inspired word of God, how can we account for all these variations and potential discrepancies?
That's an important question and one that a lot of people wrestle with.
Mm.
But I think it's crucial to remember that inspiration doesn't necessarily require dictation.
Right.
God can work through human authors, allowing their unique voices and styles to shine through while still ensuring the truthfulness and authority of their words.
So God's not a puppet master dictating every word and comma.
Right.
It's more like a collaborative dance.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And the Bible itself affirms this idea. Look at the books of Samuel and Kings, for example. The authors explicitly mention their sources and the fact that they're compiling and summarizing historical accounts.
Right. They're acknowledging that they're drawing from a variety of materials and shaping them into a coherent narrative. It's not meant to be a dry historical textbook.
Exactly. And inspiration doesn't mean there can't be approximate language, round numbers, summaries, or even non-chronological arrangements of events. As long as the author isn't explicitly claiming a strict chronological order, there's room for literary and thematic considerations.
So it's not about finding a perfect one-to-one correspondence between the Gospels, but rather about appreciating the overall harmony of the message they convey.
Right.
There's a bigger picture here.
Exactly. And remember, the Bible affirms its own trustworthiness. It encourages us to seek harmony in the Scriptures, even when we encounter apparent difficulties.
Right.
The fact that we don't have all the answers doesn't negate the truthfulness or authority of the Bible.
It's a reminder that faith and reason can coexist, that we can grapple with these questions without compromising our belief in the inspiration of Scripture. I appreciate that perspective.
Absolutely. The Bible invites us to engage with it on multiple levels, to explore its depths, mm-hmm. and to wrestle with its complexities.
Mm-hmm.
It's in that wrestling that we often find profound insights and a deeper appreciation for the richness and beauty of God's Word.
This has been such an illuminating deep dive. I'm starting to see the Synoptic Gospels in a whole new light. Yeah. I'm with you on that. It's really encouraging to think about the human element involved in the writing of these Gospels. It makes them feel more relatable, more alive somehow. So knowing all this, how does understanding the Synoptic problem change how you approach reading the Gospels? Do you read them differently now?
I think for me, understanding the Synoptic problem doesn't diminish my appreciation for these texts at all. If anything, it enhances it. It reminds me that these Gospels aren't sterile robotic transcripts, but living, breathing narratives crafted by skilled authors who were deeply invested in conveying the truth about Jesus.
I love that analogy. It's like realizing that a seemingly simple painting is actually composed of countless brushstrokes, each carefully chosen and applied to create a masterpiece.
That's a great way to put it. The Synoptic problem, rather than being a stumbling block, becomes an invitation to delve deeper, to appreciate the nuances, to compare and contrast, and to ultimately encounter the person of Jesus in a richer, more multifaceted way.
It reminds us that the Bible is a tapestry woven from multiple threads, a symphony of voices harmonizing to tell the grand narrative of God's redemptive love.
Beautifully said. And as we grapple with these questions, it's crucial to remember that our faith rests not on a perfect solution to every textual puzzle, but on the person of Jesus Christ himself.
So as you continue to explore the Synoptic Gospels, don't be afraid to embrace the mystery, to ask questions, and to savor the richness and depth of these remarkable texts. Who knows what treasures you might uncover along the way?
What's fascinating here is that the more we learn about the intricacies of these texts, the more we realize how much more there is to discover. It's a lifelong journey of exploration and wonder.
And on that note, we'll leave you with a thought to ponder. If Matthew and Luke did indeed predate Mark, as some scholars believe, what does that tell us about the development of early Christian thought and the process by which these sacred texts were collected and canonized? It's a fascinating question to consider as you continue your own deep dive into the world of biblical scholarship. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.